this meeting to order. We'll start with the call roll.
Rajah Acharchi.
She's on his way.
Daniel Otakwin. Amir Aftai. Sarah Almoslawi. Mackenzie Barberis.
She's abs.
Luigi Berinde.
Here.
Lydia Blum. Simone Chan. Ishan Chahir. Zora Duram. Karis Everett.
Excused absence.
Christian Flournoy.
Niles Hyatt holding a proxy.
Ezra Galperin.
Present.
Davion Geckman.
Present.
Getulio Gonzalez Mulatieri.
Present.
Holden Hitchcock. Niles Hyatt.
Here.
Sian Kim.
She's on her way.
Jeffrey Letterman.
Here.
Kathy Liu.
Here.
Flora Mee. Michael O'Donnell. John Purcell.
Here.
Saab Razak.
Yes.
Michael Scully. Jessica Silverman.
Luigi's holding her proxy.
David Soares. Christian Tarot.
Luigi, you cannot hold multiple proxies. So that's Jessica's going to have to reassign her proxy.
I think Jessica assigned me as one from the candidate formally. So can I take Jessica?
Yeah, sure.
Adam Benson. Thor Wagaspack. Jinzu Wu. Eric Yao.
Present.
Stefan Zhang.
Franklin Berry is holding his proxy.
He's back.
How many are present?
I have 21, but I counted the people that you said were on the way as well. So I'm going to say that was like two of them. So 19 currently in the room with two on the way.
Okay, we've hit quorum. Thank you. Cornell University is located on the traditional homelands of the Gaigahono. The Gaigahono are members of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, an alliance of six sovereign nations with a historic and contemporary presence on this land. The Confederacy precedes the establishment of Cornell University, New York State, and the United States of America. We acknowledge the painful history of Gaigahono dispossession and honor the ongoing connection of Gaigahono people, past and present, to these lands and waters. Please review the January 30th meeting minutes. Representative Aftab.
Motion to amend the minutes to include me and Representative Blum as present.
Second.
Any dissent? None is so moved. Any further edits?
Motion to approve.
Any dissent? Seeing none, these meeting minutes are approved with that amendment. Okay. We'll now move to reports of officers, committees, and liaisons. Does anyone have any announcements? Seeing none, we'll move to presentations. We'll just wait for Dr. Maddox to get here, which will not take very long. He's waiting outside. Okay, perfect. Thank you.
permission to approach the bench.
Let Representative Mavar make this introduction as he is our IT governance liaison.
Hi, everyone. I am pleased to introduce Ben Maddox. He is the Chief Information Officer for Ithaca and the Ithaca supported campuses. And also joining us on Zoom is Becky Joffrey. She is the Director of Innovation and Strategy within Cornell IT. Welcome, and thank you both for being here today.
Thank you.
Hey, Becky.
And
hi, everybody. Thanks a lot. I don't always sound like I ate gravel for breakfast, but I'm getting over a cold. I'm not contagious. I don't have COVID or anything, but I really didn't want to miss this opportunity. For those of you who are at my back, hi, everybody. It's really great to be here. Becky, my colleague in IT, and I have worked really hard this last year to meet a lot of you and to engage the student community in a bunch of new initiatives. So I'm just really thrilled to be here. I'll tell you a little bit about myself. So first of all, my name is Ben Maddox. I joined Cornell about a year ago. I'm almost at 15 months. You'll hear me say some y'alls and I'll drop a few G's in there. I did grow up in a really small town in South Georgia, but I've been in the New York City and now upstate area for a long time. I moved to New York to go to graduate school at NYU, where I studied cognitive science. And then I went to University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia to do my doctorate. And that was when I was first introduced to Cornell. As a part of my study, I was thinking about how big institutions change or sometimes don't change or have a hard time changing. And I was really interested in Cornell's early mission of any student, any course, and also do the greatest good, and how that mission had evolved over time but stayed really consistent. So I had a chance to meet with the then president of Cornell and some other leaders and came to some student groups and others to hear their perspective on how change had occurred or hadn't occurred at Cornell over the years. And I told myself then, if I ever had a chance to be a part of the Cornell community, I would take it really seriously. And so about 18 months ago in recruitment for the Chief Information Officer role, I got a call and they said, hey, you know, I'd really like for you to consider this role. I had been at NYU in a very similar role prior to that and have a faculty appointment still at NYU where I teach and advise doctoral students. But as soon as I came on campus to begin the meetings, I've already 47 people I met on my interview day. So that was a good trial by fire. But I really felt a kinship here with mission and a sense that technology could help us enable the Cornell mission. And I've been really thrilled to join the community. And it felt such a great welcome in the last year or so. So I appreciate being here. I really enjoy and have enjoyed all the different student forums. I've had a chance to meet a number of the student assembly members and the leadership from last year, outgoing leadership, and at university assembly. So basically, if there's a grocery store opening with a ribbon cutting that has to do with Cornell, I'll be there. And I hope today can be a chance for y'all to bring questions to me and ideas to me or frustrations to me. That's really what I'm here for. I was drawn originally to technology and a study of sort of how technology impacts the way we think and the way we see the world neurologically and psychologically. And over time, I got a real interest in technology and learning and pursued that as an instructor. I also really find the aspects of technology in university life fascinating. My job is sort of like running technology for a city. You know, there's about 40,000 people involved in the Cornell University community here and in New York and in Doha. And it's just a real thrill to be a part of that. So I'm going to stop there and let Becky introduce herself. And then I'll come back and tell you just a little bit about the CIO role and some of the things we've got going on. And then I would love to open the floor for questions. Becky, hi.
Hi there. So I'm Becky Joffrey. I've been at Cornell now for 11 years. My primary career in my past life was in marketing. I worked at Nestle and did an MBA internship at American Express. And then I joined higher ed, and I was fascinated at how higher ed institutions did their jobs without technology that helped them like engage with their customers. You know, they had like payroll systems and these back office systems, but not a lot of engagement systems. And so that was sort of my entry into central IT, as I recognized the need for the kinds of systems that an American Express uses in terms of just having an ongoing relationship with people. And so like many of you, when I joined, I didn't really understand what a central IT organization does. And then I joined it and just really discovered the depth of technology and how it touches every aspect of your experience, even if you don't see it. So that's a little bit of the perspective I think that I bring to this group. And I'm thrilled to have worked with Nicholas as we've established these governance committees in domains. He's been a real asset to have, and he's joined many of the committees. And so just like you guys have this governance organization, IT needs governance. And we didn't really have it. A lot of technology decisions were just coming into Ben and I and the rest of the team. And, you know, it was like thumbs up, thumbs down. And, it was very ad hoc. And so what we're trying to do as an organization is be more methodical and thoughtful about the technology investments we make. And so what we've done is we've set up these domains. There's four of them. There's research, teaching and learning, campus community technology, which is all the physical, the library system, the CUPD, any kind of advising systems that exist. Those are all community technology. And then the last one is administrative systems. So these are our big enterprise systems like finance and HR. And so, and then in addition to that, we have an AI advisory council, because as you know, AI is just, you know, making its way into the world. And we want to make sure that we're thoughtful about that. So Nicholas is your representative on many of these committees, and I'm happy to tell you more, but it's an exciting time for IT, having been at our helm and having all this great energy. So thank you for inviting me to your meeting.
Great. So maybe I'll take a couple of minutes to just talk a little bit about the organization and kind of my approach. I think you'll probably hear as I talk about this, last year I went to Cornell commencement for the first time. So how many people will be graduating this year? Is anybody graduating this spring?
Anybody from here?
Who's a third year? Okay, second years. And what about first years?
Anybody first year on the back row? Okay, good luck. You're almost there.
And a couple here, right? Yeah. So more than 8,000 Cornellians entered the world post school last year, either for grad school, for fellowships, for international occupations, or for domestic jobs. And when I was at commencement for the first time, it connected me in such a terrific way to this sense of community here, right? And I think probably growing up in a small town and then moving to a huge place like New York City, which for anybody who spent time in New York City knows, New York City is 8 million people who all live in communities of about 3 blocks, right? So you walk down my husband teases me all the time. He's like, why is the bagel guy happy to see you? And I'm like, because he sees me every day that I'm in New York City. And now I've tried to build the same friendships at College Town Bagels down on the Commons where I live in Ithaca. But I really do approach my work and my teaching with a sense of community. And that meant for me a bunch of listening tours. So when I first arrived, We set up over the first 6 weeks, yes, about 180 meetings, including the then president of student assembly and others in university assembly and around the university. I even went to faculty senate in the first couple of weeks here. And has anybody ever been to faculty senate?
Right.
So has anybody ever had a root canal at the dentist?
Whoever remembers getting a root canal right now.
Okay. So I'm not saying that's what it's like. I'm just was asking two separate questions. So, but actually I really loved it because it gave me a sense of the culture of the community here. And, but I knew when I made that first almost 200 meetings, one of the things that people mentioned to me most consistently was an interest in having more of a voice in how IT is prioritized at the institution. And that's going to vary from constituent to constituent in the same way that your experience may vary based on school or discipline, whether you live on campus or off campus, what kinds of interests you have extracurricularly or co-curricularly. But I knew from the beginning that we had an opportunity to better engage the broader community in how IT is planned, how we think about IT investments. One of the second most prominent things that I heard about, how many people use the student information system, PeopleSoft? To register for your classes or pick your classes, does everybody log into that torturous thing?
Okay.
So, I'm not going to ask who likes it or who feels tortured by it, because every student that I met with was really frustrated by that. So the second most prominent thing that I heard, certainly from the student and faculty community, was a frustration with that student information system for registration and for things like drop ads and this kind of stuff. And so we pretty immediately focused on governance that Nicholas and others have helped us think about. So in addition to my being here, I can't wait to answer questions and help you think about things, but I also have a request, which is if you're interested in participating more broadly in how IT governance decisions are weighed and thought about and made, please let Nicholas know and he'll bring that to our attention. There's a lot of opportunity to serve and get involved. It doesn't take a huge amount of time, but it is about another committee meeting, probably. I'm sure y'all have plenty of those, but we'd really love your voice. Or if there's any time that you want to sit down with a group or with me or with certain areas of the IT teams here at Cornell, we're happy to do so. So we're kind of using right now Nicholas as a liaison for this governance work and community engagement. Please let us know. So we'd love to have you. So I'm going to put that ask out there. I think the third thing that I heard in the listening rounds was some concerns about security and making sure that IT security was both appropriately secure and still didn't lock down things that people have to use. I know dual authentication and that kind of stuff, those have been things that people have had to get used to. We also have a mandatory training for all staff and faculty across the university for IT security, and we saw a 98.7% completion rate of that, and we saw a 20% drop in individually caused security incidents at Cornell. So where somebody clicks a link and that ends up causing a problem, a data breach, or even a banking issue for them, that kind of stuff. So I knew we needed some work in that area, so we've instituted that. I was also really excited about Gen AI, and that was kind of the third thing that people were really fired up about, really worried about. What's interesting to me is the range of enthusiasm versus concern that people voiced. It felt like everybody I met with had a really different perspective. Either generative AI is going to ruin the world and shut down the power grid, or it's going to save the world and enable all kinds of new learning and automation and growth and change. And I frankly think that AI has the power to do both. And we're seeing that in a lot of different ways. But we wanted a model that connected to that community engagement strategy for AI at Cornell. So, and we can share this URL afterwards. But last spring, we launched a site at Cornell where any person at Cornell, student, faculty, or staff can submit a project for AI that they think helps solve a problem. We had several student projects come out of it. We've had almost 100 projects submitted to the university that could benefit from or potentially help us solve problems for the institution around generative AI. And it's been so cool. We had a demo day a couple weeks ago to help hear, help people see what those, some of those early findings are. So that's going to be ongoing, and that's another area of ask if you're interested in generative AI, either on the tech side or thinking about how generative AI might make a difference. There's opportunities to do so. And so those are kind of among the first few things that I heard. And in my first year, I really have focused on addressing key concerns and then really spending time engaging with the community so that for the coming year and the future years, we feel like IT priorities and investments are set by the community, with the community, and for the community wherever possible. I know you might not think it's very interesting to have a great procurement system, like Becky was saying, for administrative purposes, but we procure almost $1 billion worth of stuff. That's mice inventory systems and paper for printers and devices and books and library systems and all kinds of stuff. So there's those kinds of systems, though they can feel a little bit mundane, are really important in the same way that systems like Canvas are, that you use every day for your classes and teaching and learning work, or secure computational resources that we use at Cornell for almost $2 billion worth of research that has incredible impact both for the local community and the state and around the world. So there's a bunch of variety in all this, but I really feel like Cornell has a power of collective strength and the power of creative ideas. So the better Becky and others and I can help engage the community to solicit ideas and priorities, the better I can hear from you about what's important and what concerns you in any area, the better I can help lead and support and be an advocate for the needs that you may have in the undergrad and grad community. So that's about 6 minutes of where I've spent my time in the last 15 months. I'm really excited to hear from you. I'm totally happy to take questions about my leadership and how I approach that, or what I'm thinking about tech in the world, or what I teach in my classes, and that kind of stuff. Happy to take any questions. So I'll stop there and open the floor. If you wouldn't mind, just say your name and maybe what you're studying or what you're interested in and what questions you have.
Representative Galperin.
Hi, thank you for being with us.
Sure.
I'm Ezra, I'm a government major. This feels like freshman orientation all over again. Okay. So I want to talk about security for a second.
Yeah.
I had a lot of people, just like in passing, complain to me about the new system on Duo Mobile where we have to input a code. I, for one, have found it to be quite inconvenient, so I was wondering if you could explain why that was implemented and why it was deemed that just the verification was not enough.
Sure. So did everybody hear the question right? Okay, yeah. So though that change was made before I got here, I sort of helped implement that change at a previous institution. So the number one cause, 96% of data breaches in the U.S. are caused by individual failure. And that usually has to do with passwords. Either your password gets caught mid-world, or it gets caught from another machine or some, or people click a link and then that drives to your information being shared. So in the space of cybersecurity, the use of codes, or you're seeing a new change, even a lot of people are just using a fingerprint authentication or face ID. Anytime you can use something like an independently generated code, as opposed to a password that gets passed across the network, it's more secure. So recognizing that it is kind of a headache, there still are all the capabilities. You can still use multiple types of authentication in Duo, but that code came from password sharing and the fact that statistically most of the data breaches that we get are that individual error. But I'm happy to take it back and see, is there another method that you think would be better or easier for you?
Honestly, I didn't think that far ahead, but I'll get back to you.
Okay, yeah, just think about it. You know, I mean, there are some new technologies that we're introducing now, like I said, face ID and fingerprint stuff that are even more convenient. A variable for that is I see a mix of Apple's and Microsoft machines here. So Apple's usually have the ability to do a fingerprint. And if you have a camera, you can do a Face ID, but some Microsoft devices and older devices don't have that. So it's not universally available for folks, but we're looking at even easier solutions for that, Ezra. So thanks for your question.
Okay, I've written down an order and how I saw placards. So I have next as Representative Gonzalez Baltieri, and then Representative Wazak, and then Representative Letterman, Representative Yao, Representative Bloom, Representative Wu, Representative Hitchcock. Your name was not called on the list. Please raise your hand. Okay, so we're going to go in that order. Representative Gonzalez Baltieri.
Hello, thank you for being here. My name is Jitalio Gonzalez Molitieri. I'm a student at the Brooks School of Public Policy.
Oh, congratulations. That's a great new school. I'm working with your dean a lot and really happy to see the school was founded and getting rolling. That's great.
Yeah, Dean Barry is pretty cool. So I have a question. Like, I have two questions. One question is, what resources, cybersecurity resources, that students or the student body might have access to that we're unaware of, that you might want to share with us? And also, regarding the digital divide, I'm sure you know what that is. A lot of rural communities outside of or surrounding Tompkins County, I'm sure, suffers from digital divide. Is there any sort of initiative that the school is working on to leverage its resources to help those communities, and how can students get involved?
Yeah, okay, let's see. Let's take the first one. So, So the first question, which focuses on tools that are available for students for cybersecurity. So both all the tools that we use, like Duo and either Microsoft or Google, I'm assuming most of y'all use Gmail and Canvas does everybody use Canvas for your learning management systems? So all of those, I think I'll say this first, which is universal, which is students, faculty, and staff have essentially universal coverage at the university from a cybersecurity standpoint. So, and that includes maybe three main things. So I'll say encryption, like passwords and Duo Mobile. The second is all of the big systems that we use, like Canvas or Google or Microsoft, have extensive privacy and protective contracts around that. You know that probably you've heard the term FERPA before. That's your student data from grades to those advising records that Becky mentioned in her comments. So all of those are governed by both federal and local and contractual policies that protect our data and secure our data. The third universal is about all the systems that we have in the cloud, like Canvas. So there are contractual obligations that Canvas not only backs those up, but if they had a catastrophic failure, they have backups of that, they have backups of backups, you know. And so I think the cloud strategy, for the most part, that Cornell was really one of the leading institutions to move from things that were housed in an on-premises data center to the cloud, has really created a more secure environment for students, staff, and faculty. We do offer to anyone who wants to training and opportunities to meet with the security team. And eCornell has excellent programs on IT security. But if you're interested in learning more about what the security team does and maybe what cybersecurity looks like, we'd love to have, I know the Chief Information Security Officer and their team would love to spend time with folks. But the goal has been, I'll get to your second question, try to get second question quickly. On the digital divide, the goal has been to create as few divides as possible for students, staff, and faculty that are at Cornell, that are in the degree programs, so that coverage is a pretty big umbrella for all of us. And those include like Ezra's headaches about Duo. That means everybody's obligated to do the same thing. So we sort of share the same burdens. But that goal has really been to have universal coverage on that. Becky, did you have a comment on the cybersecurity work?
Yeah, I heard the question slightly differently. And if it's not what you asked, I think it could be something that you're also interested in, which is just what resources in general can we provide to students that might be exciting? And so I would add to all the cybersecurity stuff, you know, we have a really robust AI program. And we're trying hard to figure out, you know, as Ben mentioned, we have this experiment model. And so students can get involved in actually building AI solutions for campus. Nicholas Maggard is taking part in that this semester. So he can tell you more, but I think there's a lot of resources in the AI world that we should explore together and figure out how to make those kinds of resources available to you. We are standing up a new AI website, and there'll be some sort of intro courses listed on there that you can take. So that's one area. And a third area, you know, there's cybersecurity, AI, I think also is just, you know, how do we make your Cornell experience better? And it's interesting because Ben has a phrase, you know, Cornell is like a lot of columns, like you have to move from silo to silo to silo. And we're really trying to think about the student experience more broadly. You know, you have all these micro journeys in your Cornell experience. You know, you're a student, you might be a study abroad person, you join clubs, you apply for programs and fellowships, you look for a job. And so we're looking at technology that crosses the silos. And so I think there's a real opportunity there for us to think together about how to improve that experience.
Just to add to that question, are there like any tools similar to like VPN that like would protect students' data and privacy that are available to the student body?
Yeah, so in case folks don't know that, VPN is a virtual private network where so banks, for example, if they're doing transactions from one bank to another, sometimes they have a dedicated private network and a VPN called a tunnel, which sort of encompasses that data. So the encryption and the protections that we have in all of those big university systems are essentially when you're on campus and you're logged in with your secure NetID and password, you are in a virtual private network. And some of our systems for staff who manage things like SIS, which has all the transcripts in it, if they're off campus, they have to use a virtual private network for access if they have system level access. But when you log into those, once you hit that, again, Canvas or SIS, that information is encrypted and secured behind your login, you know? So the virtual private network is something that, again, folks use. Our faculty, for example, would use a virtual private network login if they're in Shanghai and they need to reach back. And for example, if they're at one of the international locations, they might use that to access information back here. So I want to get to the community stuff because that's really one of the most pressing things that I felt when I began. So I am here usually 3 or 4 days a week in Ithaca. And because I oversee Cornell Tech and work really closely with Weill Cornell Medicine, the medical school and the physicians operation, I'm usually here Sunday to Wednesday. Then I drive with my dog in the back seat to New York City, and I'm at Weill Cornell on Thursdays and Cornell Tech on Fridays. So it's a little crazy. I'm like, I need a helicopter or something. I've definitely observed, you know, the challenge of a lot of the areas like where I grew up in the Deep South have really felt that manufacturing loss and don't have that infrastructure. So I asked that same question when I got here, and one of the most vibrant programs that Cornell has is the cooperative program. So we have staff really through the partnership with CALS in every county in the state. And they work with local communities to better understand particularly food and nutrition, but also technology needs. And so they're in all 78 counties. I think I've got my count right. Somebody can check me. All 78 counties of New York, we have individuals there, and we meet with them every 4 to 6 weeks to sort of hear from them. And Cornell supports the local community by doing things like investing in the local community here to support additional school systems and individual schools and things like the TCAT bus network and that kind of stuff. So Cornell is really engaged, I think, in the well-being of the state and the community, which is part of what drove me here in the first place. We are very active in the public university system and what's called the NREN system. Sorry over all the acronyms, but you know, IT people love acronyms. That's a National Research and Education Network. So all the universities are connected to one another with sort of a low-cost network that allows us to communicate. And those also branch out into the communities that have like community colleges and others. And Cornell has been a real leader in that space to provide more equity and connectivity, at least for the other higher education institutions. So I want to do more. I'd love to see us do more, but, and I'm kind of still learning that, but the co-op program and the participation in the research and education networks are the two areas that I think are really exciting about where we're making a local impact.
Next will be Representative Razak.
I'm not good at short answers, y'all. I'm sorry about that. Okay, but you guys will flag me if I run long on time or something.
It's 5:20 right now.
Okay.
I don't have a ton for today.
Okay.
Thank you for being here. Not yet. Dr. Maddox, can you hear me?
No, just call me Ben, please. Okay. I mean, you can call me Dr. Maddox if you want to, or Dr. Ben, that's what my students call me. But yeah, but Ben is fine.
Okay, thank you for being here. So my question is that obviously Cornell collects a lot of our data, like a lot. So I know that the university has a duty under FERPA to keep that data private, but I just want to hear from you that the university is guaranteeing that even if the university comes under pressure from the federal government to hand over sensitive student data, they won't do that.
Thanks for that. So the university is governed by three or four major federal regulations. Among those are FERPA, which is focused specifically on educational and research data. The second is HIPAA data, which probably y'all know HIPAA has to do with personal health information. The third is a lesser known acronym, Gram-Leach-Bliley, which has to do with financial information and how that is protected. So all of those regulatory institutions, as well as things like consent, you know, how different states have requirements for consent for recording and that kind of stuff. And so there are a lot of laws around privacy that also govern the institution. So, we are assessed and we have to self-attest and we have internal audits and external audits against all of those systems to make sure that we're in compliance with federal, local, state laws that regulate data, as well as privacy laws that talk a little bit about who can share what. Some of you may know that with under FERPA, for instance, you have to give the institution permission to share your grades with your caregivers. And you can imagine that when that was first introduced, there were a lot of unhappy caregivers that was the policy, but you know, you're adults here and that's how that regulation is covered. And so right now, because Cornell is a private institution, you hear of the Freedom of Information Act. So there are certain broad-based information that private universities can attend to from a Freedom of Information Act, but for the most part, it takes a subpoena. So there are legal requirements that you have to comply to hand over information if it has to do with an investigation or a legal case, but those have to be subpoenaed. You know, those have to be formal and those can have to be litigated and adjudicated in order for information to be handed over. So we are lucky that all of those federal safety nets are in place, and we're lucky that we attest and we have internal audit and external audit and third-party groups that help us attest to that physical security and digital security. So that's kind of how the information is governed and how we manage it and how things would only be released that are in compliance with those federal legislative laws or a specific legal case.
Next is Representative Weideman.
Hi, Ben.
Hi.
My name is Jeffrey. I am a representative of the engineering school, and I have two quick questions for you. First off is about the student center system, which you briefly mentioned in terms of the signing up for classes and things like that. I know that a major challenge students face is, especially for pre-enroll, having issues where it basically whoever has the fastest internet gets the classes, things like that. And I'm not sure if this is the IT department or if we need sort of a bigger change in how classes are selected, where you have like cohorts or something like that. I was wondering if there was a timeline for improving that whole process, because I know that's like probably the most single prominent IT issue facing students right now. My second question is more engineering focused. I've spent a lot of time working with the procurement system for project team funding, and there are a couple of...
I'm sorry to hear that. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a amazing opportunity to be able to order things. However, there are some issues, for example, workday requirements for approving carts. And you have to individually submit even orders for like 5 cent parts. And you have 200 of them and you click through and it takes like 2 hours, things like that. I don't know if there were any conversations, but if there haven't been about that, I'd love to sort of open up a dialogue about that too. Thank you.
Sure. Thanks for that. Tell me your name again.
Jeffrey.
Jeffrey. Thanks, Jeffrey. I like it that the engineer has a two-parter with a complicated technical one on both. So the student information system, I have to say, so the person who oversees the student information system is the registrar. And Rhonda is just a terrific person. So I took her out to lunch maybe the first 2 weeks that I got here. And I said, hey, listen, let me buy you a cup of coffee and you can really tell me about the state of the student information system at Cornell. And she said, if you really want me to tell you about the state of information, student information system, it's going to take more than coffee. I think I need a margarita or something. And she was right that we just had coffee. Because I think that investment strategy just didn't quite have the right advocates. And I think Rhonda and I, and some of you may know Lisa Nishi, the Vice Provost for Undergraduate Academic Affairs and Enrollment. So the three of us partnered as pretty about within the first few months that I got here. And there are two key areas that we are focusing on. One is wait lists, and the second is prerequisites. So for anybody who takes classes in different schools, you may have seen that whether or not there is a wait list depends on if a school has had money to create a system, because the student information system centrally does not have a waitlist system deployed. Now, the tool that Cornell has is capable of deploying a waitlist system, but it just hasn't been deployed here. It's kind of an expensive deal. The same thing for prerequisites. To Rhonda's and my consternation, right now, if a department needs to know if Jeffrey, you're gonna take an upper level course and you have, they literally look it up either in a PDF or a physical course description to figure out if you can take that next level course. You can imagine delays and ineffectiveness and inefficiency there. So two of the systems that we're investing in, what year are you?
I'm a junior.
You're okay, so we might be there by the time you finish, if you finish within the next year or so. So two of the systems that we're investing in are the prerequisites, so that those would get rolled out a school at a time when the school is ready for that. They need to sunset their old systems and then make it available in the new student information system. So there's a multi-year investment strategy in the advising system, wait lists, prereqs, another one called degree audit, so that you would be able to follow your progress more regularly. So most undergraduate programs require 123 credits for graduation. Sometimes people get to their junior or senior year, they're on track with the number of credits, but maybe not the right classes. And then if those aren't offered, so this new degree audit capability will allow both advisors and students to track that progress. So those are among the first three in a three-year roadmap. And I'd be happy to come, or maybe Rhonda would come with me at a future date to talk a little bit about those improvements, because we co-invested in those together, the registrar, enrollment management, and IT. I felt that was really urgent. You know, if y'all said, why not just get a whole new system? The current system is so underwater, you couldn't even really replace it. It's kind of like rowboat to speedboat without putting a little motor on the back. So we've really been challenged by that, but I feel like we've got a good investment strategy moving forward in that and a good team around it. We brought in some third party contractors and stuff. So thanks for that question. I believe that will improve everybody's experience, grad and undergrad and faculty and TAs and instructors. So thanks for asking that question. The second one, remind me again.
It was pure procurement for.
Oh my gosh, yes. So Becky and her team, that's one of the AI innovation projects to work on Concur, which is the travel and reimbursements, which has a big thing to do with procurement, because if somebody procures something on a card and needs to get reimbursed, they have to go through 9 levels of approvals and stuff. So there is an AI project to work on improving that whole process. The one thing that I think we can't quite address yet is what are eligibility, the best eligibility policies and practices for students who are doing procurement on behalf of a project. Grad students can do that because they sort of have an employment type activity. So I just met with the career services folks about student employment IT roles and talking about eligibility for system access for student employees. So that's in process, but you'll at least be a senior by the time that's resolved, if not a graduate. You may have to support us as an alum on that, but Becky and the team are doing some really cool work on improving those services in AI, and I'll let Becky mention that.
Hi, Jeffrey. I love that question. And I think you put your finger on it a little bit, that when we improve technology, it's about more than just the technology. There's a lot of policies and legacy process that goes into sort of creating those systems. So why you have to submit a form for a 5-cent, bolt, that could be as much policy as technology. And, I do recognize that we have multi-step systems and we have lots of regulations around them. And so one of the things that we are focused on with AI is looking broadly at, how many touch points a single transaction, how many does it really need to go through, and are there thresholds, 5 cents, okay, maybe that's that, you don't need to like go through all the approvals, you can go buy the bolt. it's sort of I don't know if in engineering, what's your major within engineering? I'm curious.
I'm an engineering physicist.
Oh, got it. Well, if you were a supply chain operations engineer, then you could help me solve it, or if that's an interest, because I think there's a lot of analysis to go into fixing some of these processes.
But at least you can help us test the velocity of the transaction, right? So we'll do that. One of the interesting things that's come up in this, our lead for AI, for generative AI, and Becky are bringing in AWS this spring to look at exactly this workflow question. When we met with Amazon Web Services as AWS, and we asked them, they use some of the same systems. And we were like, well, how does that work for reimbursement? And they were like, well, I scan my receipt and then I get a direct deposit for the reimbursement. And it takes about 11 and a half seconds for me to scan that. And Becky and I were just thumping our head against the table because it's, as Becky said, there are 5 to 9 steps involved in approvals for some of these activities. So AWS is joining the AI project for the travel and reimbursement effort this spring. They gave us free resources to engage in that because they use some of the same systems. So I think by May at the demo day for the AI projects, we'll have some findings around this and improvements. So both of those are underway. So we'll see where we head. Yeah, but thanks for the question.
Thank you.
My question was already answered.
Okay. Can you tell me your name and what you're interested in? Anyone?
Yeah, of course. My name's Eric. I'm studying operations research.
Oh, great. Okay, thanks.
Representative Blue.
Hi, sorry. My voice is so bad today.
Hey, listen, we're kindred spirits on this, right? So, yeah.
My name's Lydia. I'm studying environment sustainability.
Environmental sustainability?
Yeah, environment sustainability.
And which school is that in?
CALS.
In CALS, okay.
Yeah. Again, apologies for my voice, it's really bad. Anyways, my question kind of concerns a concern my roommate brought to me. She was saying how she's been seeing these posters across campus saying like, hey, like join this AI group chat, like this study group chat. And people join it and then their information gets taken because it's not a real group chat. And she said one of the professors like warned her about this. So I was just wondering if you've heard anything about it, slash are there initiatives to kind of stop that from happening? Because she said she almost signed up for it until the professor was like, hey, this is a scam, like this isn't real.
So A, don't, please. You do have access to Copilot. So I haven't heard about that one. If you have a chance, maybe if your roommate has maybe if there's a picture or anything, or just remembers what it said. There are a lot of legitimate tools that can help with efficiency that you can utilize. But one of the reasons why, when we launched the AI program, we worked with Microsoft to ensure that the Copilot tool was available here. And I met with a group of students in the spring who were in a class on innovation. I met with them at the beginning of the semester and the end of the semester. And one of the things we talked about was the fact that even though a log-inable version of Microsoft Copilot is available for all students, staff, and faculty at Cornell, we needed to increase the visibility of that. So beginning of this semester, we had some tables in the dorms and other things, and we've seen an increase in utilization. But if you haven't logged in, I would encourage you, if you need or are interested in utilizing AI for any of your administrative or academic work at the institution, Copilot is available to everyone. You need to log in with your same credentials, but it is a secure FERPA and HIPAA level secure tool. I mean, I encourage anybody entering anything into a digital environment to be thoughtful and deliberate about what you enter. But Copilot is available for everyone. Copilot is really a brand for ChatGPT. You know, Microsoft invested $10 billion in OpenAI, which is the company that founded ChatGPT. So Copilot is ChatGPT. It's based on the same thing. It's that deal. But our version of Copilot, when you log in, is privatized and it's ephemeral, meaning that it is not logged. Nobody logs that information. Nobody tracks that information. Microsoft does not. We do not. If you save it in your own queue in Copilot, you can go back to it, you can copy it, but the institution does not monitor that. That's for our use to encourage people to get used to it and utilize it in a more secure way. So there are two instances of chatbots available at Cornell. You can use a chatbot for feline health, which is available through the College of Veterinary Medicine if you're interested in cats, and it is called ChatGPT. And there's another one for dogs that's being launched this spring. That's one of the AI projects. And then there at the university IT help desk, you can go use that. And we have found a lot of people are using that instead of making a phone call or submitting an email. So there are legitimate chatbots that are available at the institution. They're branded and you use the same kind of practice that you do for other things. You look at the URL, you look at who sent it, you look at what they're asking for you to do to log in. So, you know, my general thinking would be, right, for me, for instance, I just don't log into something for work use that's not using my NetID and password and dual authentication. That's kind of my cardinal rule. And then if there's something outside of that, I'll explore it from there. But yeah, so if you have any more information, if you forget my name, Ben Maddox, you can send it to Nicholas, he can zip it over to me. But any information, if somebody sees something like that, it's kind of like the New York subway. If you see something, say something. If you see something like that, don't utilize it. The new China DeepSeek tool for Gen AI, I would not encourage you to use that at this point. The web version is a little bit less dangerous, but right now, downloading the app, if you read through the terms and conditions, you'll see very clearly that it's not the kind of terms and conditions that you're used to that talk about privacy. And that's cultural. I mean, the creators get to decide what those terms and conditions are, and they did. But we're looking at a secure version of that that could be loginable, at least for researchers. But for now, I would just tell people to hang back on that and use the other tools that are provided to you as a part of the Cornell community, and just hold off on experimentation unless you're doing that specifically as a part of a course, or like you were asking about security tools as a way to explore that. So I'm just kind of urging us to all be deliberate and thoughtful about that stuff. Thanks for the question.
Thank you.
So it's currently 5:39. There are three more questions in the queue.
Let's go for it. Let's go for it.
Hello, my name is Jinjo Wu, and I'm double majoring in government and computer science. So I interact with IT every day, and I really appreciate the work that IT at Cornell brings, like the innovation that IT at Cornell brings to us. My question is actually about the Copilot.
About
I'm taking about the Copilot.
Oh yeah, okay.
And I'm taking a course this semester, and it allows like use of generative AI. That's the first time that I found out about the Copilot. So I actually have two questions about this. And the first one is that you talked about how you want to advertise the Copilot, but I wonder about your specific plans for raising people's awareness about this service that Cornell provides and paid for. Because from my experience, not a single student around me know about that except for in that same class. And the second question is that is IT at Cornell doing any research on the use of generative AI in the educational setting? Because I know that it's definitely widely used in the university. So I wonder if you have any official research on how that should be applied in a classroom setting.
Yeah, great. Thanks for those questions. So first, I would love for any of you to log into Copilot, and if you have a good experience, share that with your friends if you haven't already. When I met with a class in the fall, they agreed to sort of do a survey of students that were in their programs, and it was a pretty wide range of folks in information science, computer science, engineering, and humanities. So and they found the same thing in the fall semester, which was the folks who knew about it utilized it, but the folks who didn't were surprised when they learned that it was available. And so A, we would love your help in broadening the awareness of that. What we did this time, we followed the recommendations at the end of the semester of this one class that I met with, and I'd welcome additional input. And we had tables set up on campus to just remind people that it was there. And we included it in both the libraries and IT spring semester announcements. And we saw a nice uptick in that. And it was interesting because the students in the class said, "We'll send it by email." And I said, "Oh my gosh, you know, are you reading email?" And they said, "Well, at least one of my friends reads email and then they'll tell me about it, you know?" So, so we're looking for different ways to spread the word. So we'll continue to do it. But if people have ideas about different channels that you think might be helpful, that would be great. So the second question is about educational research. So the first and foremost, the Center for Teaching Innovation here at the at Cornell gave out 8 awards to faculty last spring for generative AI innovation in teaching. And so we invited all of those to come last March to an AI event on campus. And a lot of them did poster shows about what they were interested in. And I think the utilization of generative AI for teaching and learning, like most things in higher ed, relates in part to the discipline. So there are going to be areas where, for example, Jeffrey's interest in physics, you know, there may be certain utilizations there, but not as many as there might be in other areas, you know, where you're needing to do physical experiments. And in some areas of engineering, we find the same, right, where Gen AI is not going to provide that hands-on experience that you need in mechanical engineering or robotics, for example. However, when it comes to analyzing data from those experiments, it may be super helpful. So if you go, and we can share this afterwards too, there are, I think, 8 case studies on the Cornell website from the Center for Teaching Innovation that are Cornell faculty who won these awards and got appreciated and recognized for their innovation in teaching from a variety of disciplines. And they all found, you know, different levels of findings. I think the most important thing for all of us is, for me as an instructor, for y'all as students, and if you're an instructor someday, is that you give your students explicit guidance on what you're comfortable with as an instructor. So I'm glad to hear that you're in a class where it's clear what the utilization is, because I think some students have indicated to me that they have hesitation in using it because they're not sure if it's okay or not. And if they ask, is the instructor going to be frustrated with them that they want to use AI and da da da. So we really, the Center for Teaching Innovation encouraged all faculty to include something in their syllabus. So I would suggest that if there's not something in the syllabus that comments on the use of Gen AI in the class, I would ask about it. I'm going to see if Becky has additional comments on that.
So I'm curious, I love your question about how we're publicizing things. And that's a real challenge for us. You know, I joined Cornell 11 years ago, and even what I consider a fairly short time, although it's probably half your life, it felt like back, you know, at that time, you could email people and pretty much be sure that they would get your message. Or we put up posters and things on the TV screens and people would see it. But as you know, like communication is just so dispersed these days. And I don't know that we have done the best job of trying to sort of anchor against channels where you are. And we've been thinking about doing some focus groups, and this might be a really good topic. So I'm curious. I can't remember who raised their hand because I can't see. But if you'd be willing to share your name, and if you think that that would be something that this organization would be interested in, I think it might be a nice, a good relationship, a good discovery exercise for us to try to figure out how better to communicate with all of you.
Thank you so much. My name is Jinjo Wu.
Thanks. I will find you and I'll follow up separately.
Thank you. Thanks.
Representative Hitchcock.
Hello.
Hello, Ben. My name is Holden. I study food science and cows. And my questions relate to university-wide campus technologies. Specifically, I work in the Cal Student Services Office.
Yep.
And I know we have access to a platform called Dust to track distribution requirements, as well as look for petitions and other resources related to academic progress. And we're recently switching to Stellic.
That's right.
And I was curious to know if this was something that is specific to schools, because I do know in talking with people that are either part of engineering or ILR or other schools on campus that each school seems to do advising and degree audit in their own way, yeah, especially when it comes to the technology. And some people have to meet with their advisors in person. Others, like people in CALS, can just track that. And so I was just interested in just like the moving forward with Stellic, and if that was the degree audit thing you were talking about,
yep,
and looking to centralizing technology on campus. And I guess another question aside from that also relates to another university-wide technology. I'm interested in your thoughts on Cornell Chatter, because I know it was established before you were here.
Yep.
And again, like in Cal Student Services, that's how you book advising appointments.
Yep.
But other than that, it seems like anecdotally, there really isn't much people using the app. And I was just interested on that end, just like marketing resources like Cornell Chatter, if there's a incentive to remake it entirely or to reform something like that. And so those are my two questions.
Yeah, thanks. And is it Holden?
Yes, Holden.
Yeah, Holden, thanks for your question. So one of the surprising and a little bit concerning data gathering efforts that I went on when I got here is, so how many applications and services are available across Cornell, including Cornell Tech and the main campus? And the number is an astonishing 787 applications and services. Some of those are like Dusk, which is to the questions that Jeffrey was asking earlier, the student information system didn't have university-wide capability for degree audit. So schools that have a little bit more resources, or maybe an ambitious IT leader like Chris Huffnagel is at Cal's, who's such a great collaborator, stepped out in front and created those opportunities for their students locally. But what you do have there is then you get this very inconsistent experience. About 54% of students, undergrad students at Cornell, take at least one class outside their school or major. And so that creates this unevenness of experience that you're describing. So Stellic is a tool that CALS is the first school adopting it, but that's one of those SIS improvement efforts that we've invested in that'll be rolled out to all schools. So that degree audit will have a more consistent experience. Advising has a more consistent experience, because the same thing that happens with degree audit with advisors, they don't have access to information across those silos that Becky talked about. And what we were finding is if I'm a student that's needs to see a different advisor than I saw last time, and it's about a course that I took outside of my school, advisors didn't have the right information and access that they need. So we've created a much more porous system for that that will be university-wide over the next 3 years. Stellic has a 3-year rollout for all the schools. And that goes back to the equity issue, because smaller schools, newer schools, schools with less resources, with fewer students, may not have the capability to create an individual system. And so part of my focus, now the IT directors in the schools and units all have a reporting relationship with the role that I occupy as chief information officer. So we're